Vince, who will introduce the guy that gave my pinky this little splint this afternoon. And, yeah. It's one of those deals when you're a 62-year-old jock, you expect these little things to happen. And here's Vince to host the meeting.
Good evening. My name is Vince Yeo, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I, too, am glad to be here tonight, and I am very happy to have been a part of this conference. And it is a pleasure to introduce Clancy. It's a pleasure to be with him at any time. I know that most of you feel the same way. Clancy is the man in my life who's had... Clancy has had the most profound influence in my life, easily, far and away. He is certainly the most important role model I have ever had. I view him as a teacher, and he's been a teacher to me for the past 16 years. I remember, to illustrate that point, when I was new, Clancy and I one day were walking by a stream, and... Well, I knew it. And I said to him, Clancy, when do I get peace of mind? And he grabbed me by the neck. And he pushed my head under the water. And he held my head there. And I couldn't breathe. And I turned blue. And I almost suffocated. And finally, just at the very moment, when my lungs were about to burst, he picked my head up and I could breathe. And as I was gasping to catch my breath, he said to me, "What was the thing you wanted most when your head was under that water?" And I said, "Air." It was air. And then it occurred to me, I knew the message that this great teacher was trying to teach me. And I said, "Clancy, I think I know. Is it true that when I want peace of mind, as much as I want air, I will get it? And isn't that the reason you put my head underwater?" He said, "No. I was just tired of your tedious bullshit." I give you Clancy I.
My name is Clancy Imeslin. I'm an alcoholic. Really, when he mentioned I'd hurt his finger today, that really made me feel bad. He was, you know, he's 62 years old. He's really too old to be out there playing. He's a mature, well-adjusted man. I'm 62, but I'm immature and badly adjusted, so it's okay for me. But it was we had a good time out there playing. In fact, in the first inning of the first game we played, I hurt my hand too, but I haven't whined about it and gone around crying about it. I ran to first base and some big goof named Scotty, playing first base, he didn't know how to play, so caught the ball. And he knocked me down and I broken blood vessel in my hand, it's all swollen. And I wouldn't even give him the satisfaction of rubbing it. I just, "Never mind, Scotty. Get you later, babe." And I'll tell you, I was thinking tonight, taking a shower. I took a shower about 6:45. It's a good thing I get in there as early as I did, because I got hung up in that shower. I really did. I just, in the middle of my shower, it suddenly struck me, how grand I feel. And you know, that's one of the hardest things to do when you've been sober a long time, is to remember to be grateful. You talk about it, and you are grateful. But gratitude is not an ongoing emotion that people keep. You have to find mechanical ways sometimes to remind you. I think that's one of the great reasons for old-timers to go to meetings. Because from time to time, you get a kicker to remind you of your gratitude, or what might have been, or better me, better him than me, or so on. But I was thinking, isn't that miraculous? Here I am, 62, and I feel 38, I guess, today anyway, 35 maybe. I feel younger than I felt when I was 29 and went to the Texas Insane Asylum. I felt old then, and I felt broken. Last Thursday, I was thinking, again in the shower, it's no big deal. These things are not important, but they're mechanical devices for me. Suddenly struck me last Thursday, I'd spent half of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. Half of my life as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the age of 31, I was a broken old man. At the age of 62, I'm a mostly an enthusiastic, if anything, immature, unsophisticated person. I was much more sophisticated at 31 than I am at 62. But I have a great zest for life. And the other odd thing about it is, the first 31 years of my life, compared to my second 31, these last 31 have just whizzed by in many ways. You know, first 31 were just interminable, endless, year after year of hope and disappointment. And I was thinking, what stretch of circumstance could enable me to stand in a shower at some camp in Lake Arrowhead and just almost cry because I felt so good tonight? Not ecstatic, not really manic, just solid. And I was thinking how years ago in psychoanalysis and in my self-induced obsessive self-pity and in my continual evaluation of self and my rationalizations and justifications, how I used to look over my life and think of the reasons that caused me to come up short again and again. I joke about it in a sense, but in a sense I was used to hold this close to my heart, my parents leaving me with my grandparents when I was little, even though they treated me excellently. I always thought, if my parents would only been there when I was little, which is baloney, but when you're self-pitying, all becomes grist for your mill. When I was two or three years older, I was about 7 or 8 years old in third grade, and I was a good reader and a smart boy, and I was restless because their content was low, so they didn't know what to do with me. So at Christmas time, they shoved me ahead a year and a quarter in school, and which was I was at the reading level the new class was, and I was fine. But I often look back on that, and I used to look back on that and think, God, if only there would have been a Montessori school then, or some special education. Because what happened to me, they shoved me with kids a lot bigger and older than me. And from then on, I was always playing catch-up. Always, you know, I was always that kid from the third grade, it seemed to me, from then on. I was always in trouble. I was always showing off. I was always doing things. I was always in the hall. I had to prove that I was something, and I never was. And I used to think, God, if I could have been in a speeded-up course or something, with my reading ability and what they felt was my high IQ, I really could have been something. I could have been something, as the old saying goes on the waterfront. I could have been a contender somehow. Another thing that in psychoanalysis was to study this a lot, and it doesn't sound like much today, but in my youth, this was a trauma, and I usually don't talk about it. When I was 11 or 12 years old, my dad and mother got divorced. Now, that doesn't sound like much, parents getting divorced, but can you imagine? I had never seen a divorce. I had never even heard of a divorce at the age of 11. I'd never heard of a divorce. Didn't even know what they were. And here were my parents getting a divorce. And my father got married to another woman, and my mother got married to another man, and I hated them. And I tried to undermine them, and it was just hideous. And I'd live with my mother till I couldn't stand that man, And then I lived with my father, and I couldn't stand that stinking woman. And I lived with my mother, and I went to hell. That's why at the age of 15, I had some patriotism, but I ran away from home. I'm glad there was a war on, and I went and got on a ship. Because I'd have just gone somewhere. I just, always too much. And I suppose that, as I used to talk about in psychoanalysis, the trauma of being out in the middle of the ocean in a wartime situation. Vince was talking the other day. He spoke in my hometown a couple of weeks ago. And he talked to the girl who sat next to me in study hall. And it was kind of a joke. She was saying had no social skills at all as a child. Had no social skills at all. None. In fact, the big joke they laughed about, and it's funny, but one time it just wrenched me. I only had one date that anybody knew of when I was in high school, and I so little knew what to do that I asked the girl to go to a dance, and she said, okay. I said, okay, I'll meet you there. And I met her there, and I didn't understand why she was so cool, you know. But I didn't know. I'll tell you something. I don't think I've ever mentioned this before. I don't know why I'm not going to take showers anymore. Just... When I was 15, I was a junior in high school. And I was, again, a young kid compared to them, and I wasn't getting along well anyway. But there was a junior prom. I didn't know anything about the prom. But I know a lot of people went. But I was always pretended to be not interested. But there's this girl I'd seen, and she wasn't much, but she was friendly to me. So one day, I've never told this story before in my life. I may go into my Pat Clater half sobs. I'm getting an Al-Anon ray right now. I don't mean that in a bad sense, Pat. For the love of God, Montresor. One day in class, I said, you want to go to the prom? She said, yeah. I said, okay. So about 3 days before the prom, that time I was living with my father. He didn't have much money, but he took me down and they bought me a purple checked sports coat and a pair of pants and a shirt and a tie that I couldn't wear very well and some shoes. He really went all out so the little boy could go to the prom. And then someone said, you're supposed to bring the girl a corsage. So I met this girl in the hall the next day, 2 days before the prom. And I said, what kind of corsage do you want? She said, what? I said, what kind of corsage do you want? She said, for what? I said, for the prom. She says, what do you care? I said you're going to the prom with me. She said, oh, I wouldn't go to the prom with you. I was just kidding. And I didn't know how to tell my dad this because he spent all his money on these clothes. So on the evening of the prom, I pretended. I got on my clothes and I left home. And I went downtown and caught a bus to Chippewa Falls, 12 miles away, and sat in a restaurant till midnight and came home and told my dad about the prom. Now, I hadn't thought of that in years. I mean, but I used to think about it and things like that a lot. And shortly thereafter, I was hitchhiking out of Eau Claire and was on a ship in the middle, early in the Second World War, on a Pearl Harbor, where I learned to drink and discover for the first time how to remedy the terrible holes that my emotion left. And I suppose there were some, at least the psychiatrist felt there was trauma in being 15 years old. My 16th birthday, I was in Pearl Harbor, about 200 yards from Ford Island that had just been bombed by the Japanese a few months before. It was exciting and learned to drink out there. And from then on, there was always a series of traumas. Later in the war, I went in the Navy after I left the Merchant Marine, and I took some tests in the Naval Hospital, so I was able to go to college after the war. And it just seemed, as far back as I can recall, in a sense, I've always felt, to one degree or another, like that kid from the third grade. I always had to be something. Another thing that Vince brought back from Eau Claire, we laughed about, I thought about it later. The guy I went to school with, he was describing, he said, oh, he always did okay for a while, but then something would happen and he'd do something and screw it all up. Where I just felt I had to prove something and prove something. And I used to think about that a lot and think, God, if those things hadn't happened, if I would have had, if my parents had kept me at home when I was little, if there hadn't been a depression, if I hadn't been shoved ahead in that school, I would have been the smartest, I would have been the valedictorian of the class behind it. Instead, I was just a drop out of the class ahead of it. If only my parents hadn't been divorced, if I only would have had some home to I could call my own, if only I hadn't run away, if only I'd gone to the prom, if only. And I'll tell you what I was thinking tonight in the shower. Here's what I was thinking. I was thinking, if I could go back, which one of those things would I change? And I'll tell you something. I would not change a single thing. Because if I did, I might not be here today. Now that sounds odd if you're new. But I'll tell you, I know all sorts of people all over the country and all over the world. Some who are very wealthy. Some who are very famous. Some who are just have everything anyone could dream of. And to the best of my ability to judge, I would not change positions with them emotionally tonight. Because they all got their own tigers. And at least for the moment, I have mine under some sort of control. And most people don't. Now that sounds ridiculous. But that to me is how I know that Alcoholics Anonymous has altered my life. Nearly all of my life, I would have wanted to be somewhere else, doing something else in a different milieu. I'm not saying that this is the nirvana of my life, to be at the goddamn Mountain High Conference. I mean, it's nice, but it's really very good. Nice, actually. Prices are right. For speakers, but I mean, to be here in the shower tonight and thinking, I could not think of anything seriously wrong in my life. Now, how many people in the world can sit and think there's nothing seriously wrong in my life? Nothing. I've had a lot of things happen the last couple of years that were seemed serious, but you suit up and keep going through it. And come out the other side. As AA says you will, if you do not get mired down in excessive evaluations and thinking. My friend Clint helped me a great deal last year. He did something very kind for me. Many of you people, I mean, it enabled me to, maybe I could have done it anyway, but it made it easier. You know, some of you know about my wife. Just a year ago, almost died with a heart attack, and then there was months of expensive treatments and experimental treatments and trying to push balloons through her veins and medications, and then terribly expensive. Then on Labor Day, she almost died again, and she went to the hospital and had a bypass. And fortunately, she's doing very well now because she's getting some circulation in her body for the first time in years. But one of the most touching things I know, Clint Hodges, my friend, maybe, not really my friend. Because in a sense, that's really true. It sounds odd, but it's really true. You cannot allow your babies to really be friends in the real sense because you have to be willing to hurt their feelings sometimes. And you wouldn't do that to a friend. But with someone who's your baby, you have to be willing sometimes to make them not happy with you. I'm very, very close to Vince. But at lunch the other day, I hurt his feelings. And he got mad at me. And that's very understandable because you got to do that. whether or not they listen or not is all right, but that's what a sponsor's for. A sponsor's not your friend. He is when things are all right, but he's got to be more than a friend. He's got to be willing to be disliked by you to help you. Just like a surgeon has to be he cannot be your friend. Oh, I didn't want to hurt your feelings and tell you about this cancer. He has to say, you got cancer. You got to do something about it now. But Clint did something I never heard of before. He said, I know you're going to get hundreds or tens of thousands or way over $100,000 in bills. And I know it's you're going to have enough on your mind with all the other things. Just send them to my office. So for a year, every bill I got, I just sent to Clint. And he processed them all, arranged them, made the calls to the people, took care of, saw that payments were made out of insurance, just took everything. And I just, it really kept me just going fine. And that is what I call a great action. But there's been a lot of things in my life that would normally be upsetting. A week and a half ago, I had as severe a trauma as I've had, I can recall in sobriety, a week ago. And I just didn't even want to continue. A week ago tonight, I was in New Orleans, and I had to confront this thing Monday morning, and it seemed possible that everything I ever stood for was going to go down the toilet. Now that seems overdramatic, but it really did, because I wasn't sure what was coming down. And I stayed up all night. I talked to New Orleans, and I sat up all night. I was rooming with Russ, and he went to sleep, and I did crossword puzzles all night. Because I've learned one thing, you never lie in the dark and think. You do whatever you got to do. Now, that wouldn't seem much for 31 years of sobriety. You'd think you'd have some spiritual overdrive you could go into. And you can if things aren't serious, but when things are tough, you better have your crossword puzzles too. But on Monday morning, I had to go down and confront this, and I didn't want to. Part of my mind says run away, but I went down to confront it. And like most things, it dissipated in a puff of smoke. And it's all over and nothing. It's ridiculous. But again, that's another testimonial to what enables me to be here today. To be standing in the shower down there thinking, I don't have a severe problem in the world. And there's been all sorts of things happening. And none of this would have happened if I had not been gifted with that peculiar combination of curse and blessing called alcoholism. I listening to Jimmy talk last night, I know what he was saying when he said we are the chosen ones. Because you want to remember, he also said, if we choose to do the things. Because just being an alcoholic doesn't make you a chosen one, I don't think. I've had people say, we are the chosen ones because we are just alcoholics. And every day when I go to work, I step over chosen people who are dying on the street and will be dead by the end of the week. I don't think they feel as though they're chosen, and I would hate to think they are chosen. The irony of it is, they and I and you are the same creatures, and they've been given the same gift. And the question is, why don't they do something with it? All of us know alcoholics who reject, who stay in denial, who will not accept this. And it's frustrating. And it makes me angry when I see these people. I hate to see people hurt. I hate to see people I love hurt, even if it's them that's hurting them. There's a part of them that wants to, I want to smash them. Just leave my friend, the other part of your personality, alone. Stop killing him. Stop the introversion that kills them. And then I have to remember, if it were that simple, why, with all my woes and cares and self-obsessions and self-pities, why did I reject AA year after year after year after year? Why did wonderful men, they weren't really wonderful men either. That's a nice thing to say, but they weren't. It's a funny thing. I was thinking about that in the shower. I had a long shower. I really did. I stood there. I was in that shower for half an hour. I just loved it. I just felt so good. I was thinking about all these things. I think about Fred Hanawalt and Dr. John Ashby in Dallas and all the people in different cities who tried to help me. And when I was trying for them to help me, I used to think, nice, well-intentioned simpletons. They mean well, but Jesus, you know, they just don't understand that not all of us are transfixed with ecstasy over 12 steps that I would hesitate to offer to my 5-year-old child as being not up to his intellectual standards. You know, it's wonderful, but it's the same old junk. It has no place in the real world. And then after I was sober 2, 3 years, 4 years, I used to think of those guys as wonderful men. And I went back to saw every one of them in different cities. Some of you have a tape from 1983 for my 25th birthday when I went back to a number of cities and got those sponsors to make tapes of their memories of me. And they weren't very laudatory. I mean, you hear guys say, here's the craziest son of a bitch we ever had in this town. Another guy said, we never thought he was an alcoholic anyway. We just thought he was goofy. I almost cut him out of the tape. But what you're really doing well, you can include those and say, isn't that cute? If I was doing bad, that tape would have been with Rosemary Woods in no time, I'll tell you. Let me tell you a little hope, apropos of nothing. Since we're just killing time to live, dance and the show and the marshmallow roast and all the biggies coming up later tonight. I'm just filling in till the cars get moved. Let me give you some hope. It's the same thing that I see in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and a lot of places. And most of us come here with a great deal of pain and disappointed people and heartaches. Let me give you some hope. I firmly believe this. If you turn out well eventually, all of those things become humorous legends. If you turn out badly, they are proof that you always were a son of a bitch. So just work and turn out well. And they'll say, remember that time? God, that was funny. Nobody laughed when you did it. But, you know, it's funny 30 years later. But they were not wonderful men. I thought they were, but they weren't. They were men just like you and me who took it upon themselves to give themselves an extra thing to go and try to help some boob that was sullen and smart-mouthed and defensive and hid his feelings of inadequacy under a wall of a thinly applied defiance and still tried, who did things that are they ask us to do. And all of us hopefully will do it little by little. And we are not wonderful people. The tendency is always to put people far back as wonderful. You know, that's one of the things in studying history, what's so touching. Some of these great giants, the more you get to know them, they're not great giants. They're good people, trying hard, surrounded by people criticizing them. The most criticized president in American history by his peers was Abraham Lincoln. He wrote, before the second election, he and his cabinet, he had them sign a paper. They didn't know what they were signing. But he knew he'd get beaten because he was so hated by the country. And he had them explain why they did the best they could. And Washington, by the time he left the presidency, I can't wait to get out of here. These animals are killing me. And all the way through, all the great men, all the great women, were not great men and great women. They were good people. They were inspired, many of them. Some of them were charismatic. But they all lived in lives like yours and mine. You say, but they were different then. Not much different. Different, they didn't have cars, didn't have lights, didn't have lot of things. But the one thing they had that I have and you have, they all had the same emotions. They haven't found a new human emotion in 5,000 years. When I get angry, as I pretended to get at the umpire today, that's the same anger that the Pharaoh had watching rivers run red with blood, you know. Jesus! Well, he wouldn't have known to say that. Anger is anger. Frustration is frustration. Love is love. Infatuation is infatuation. Restlessness is restlessness. Discontent is discontent. Irritability is irritability. Feelings of inadequacy are feelings of inadequacy. It doesn't make any difference if you live in 1990 or whether you live in 10 BC or whether you live in 990 AD or whether you fought in the Civil War. The only difference is between people, different material things, but they change nothing. Because that's one of the great things about the course of human history. Why people have always lived with fear, sometimes I think, is that human beings can transmit scientific knowledge, knowledge of physics, knowledge of atomic energy, knowledge of all sorts of knowledge from generation to generation. The people who were born in 1950 and went to college in 1970 knew more than Einstein knew in 1940. 20-year-old kids knew more than Einstein knew because they were able to transmit knowledge. The one thing that cannot be transmitted from generation to generation is emotional maturity. Everybody has to start at zero. And the trouble, that's what makes it so frightening in the world sometimes, they're starting with great technical wisdom with zero emotions. And we all hope that people will get to the emotional degree of living in the world before they push a red button somewhere or before we all blow up. But that's the one thing that is really extraneous to me individually, because my battle is their battle and your battle. The world is all very interesting in their problems. But when it comes down to me, that is the job that I have in my life. And it's especially bad when you don't know that you have the problem, when you don't know that your feelings are not so different, that you don't know that examining causes for them is not going to help. And then to come along and discover something that makes it all right, and then have people say, you shouldn't do that. And the natural reaction, of course, must always be, I'm sure it seems that way to you, but you don't understand. When I drink, I discovered it's the only thing I've ever found that surely and instantly fills the holes that my traumas have left in my emotions. Alcohol is the only thing that has given me a momentary feeling of omnipotence that is better than anything I've ever known. Just great. I know it's a transitory thing. I know it just helps a little while maybe. Maybe it has no meaning to it. But I'll tell you, when you're empty and the hole is in your gut and the cold wind is blowing through, it doesn't mean if you get a 10-cent t-shirt on or an expensive suit, or whether you're sitting in a big advertising agency, or whether you're standing on a street corner outside of a Skid Row mission. When that wind blows through, the wind blows through. And the feelings of desperation and fear and self-pity and resentment and desperation and loneliness and knowing that if only, no lecture, no sermon, no promise is as effective as knowing that I can feel better in a few minutes. And as the warmth just pervades, you think, You know, the greatest, it's an old corny story, I'm sure everybody's heard it, but it's to me the absolutely ne plus ultra of illustrative stories of alcohol. The guy sitting in a skid row, gutter, raining, cold, his little scrap of paper, an old pencil, trying to explain to his father why he's going to commit suicide, because his father loved him. He said, "Dear Father, I know you've tried to help me and you've done many wonderful things for me." And he felt a thumping at his foot. There's a half-full bottle of cheap port wine with vomit floating on top of it. He looked up and said, "Well, might as well go out in style." And if there's anything you ever need, just let me know. That is the story of alcohol, boy. And I never knew that it didn't do that for other people. If I'd known it didn't do it for other people, then I would have some insight. All I knew is other people don't drink because they have no need to drink. I didn't know that it doesn't do that for them. There's an old tired story, again, an illustration I've used 100,000 times, but I still don't know a better way to put it. When I was about a year sober, finally held a little job in an advertising agency on Wilshire Boulevard, wrapping packages in the back, and one of our accounts was something called Kamchatka Vodka, which billboards all over Los Angeles for years are still there, but for 25, 30 years they said, "Vodka is pronounced Kamchatka." And I had been very successful in advertising briefly, and here I was wrapping packages, no front teeth, just had moved inside to a little apartment. And I thought, I'm going to tell these guys, I'm going to give them an idea. This damn billboard there is so rotten that it's tedious and old. I'm going to make my move today. And even if they don't buy it right away, they'll say, "Hey, who was that masked man with the silver bullet?" So that came by, and the art director laying out another board, same words, different copy, I mean different type style, different colors, different this and that. Copy chief there, just pronounced Kamchatka, and the count supervisor. I said, that's none of my business, but I got kind of an idea. How about this? Kamchatka vodka goes boom. Better than all vodkas anywhere. I looked at them. I got the same look I've been getting since I've been in the third grade. You know. And I thought, oh, shit. I made my move too early. Because I got the same look. And one guy said, "Well, I don't know what that's supposed to mean, but that's supposed to be funny. You know, you get a reputation of being a smart mouth. Not an attractive mouth, but a smart mouth." And the copy chief says, "Yeah, why don't you go mail your packages?" And the copy supervisor said, "If you don't like working the way we do things here, why don't you find some place that's up to your standard, yeah?" And I don't know anything worse for people who are inadequate with a little thin veneer than to be publicly humiliated. That is the one time I could kill somebody. If I'd have a gun, I'd kill him. To this day, that's why I don't like to have people I sponsor. I hate to have them. I tell them not to have guns. Because in a momentary emotional surge, they could do something that they'd not do 10 minutes later or 10 seconds later. Because people like us have a flashpoint sometimes. Especially if you're publicly humiliated when you're not feeling well. Or it's just something that makes you feel terrible. And if I would have had a gun, I just could have killed him. But I was also afraid of my sponsor. I had a mean sponsor. I thought, I didn't say anything, but I left there and I just see the terrible effect. I thought, God, I'm going to quit my job. How dare they treat me like a piece of crap? Yeah. And I saw my sponsor that day. I said, "Bob!" He said, "Jesus, hold it down, Christ. If you can't be a man, try to talk like one anyway." Now, what the hell's wrong? I told him this story. They didn't have to buy it, but they didn't treat me like a piece of crap. They're going to put me down the rest of my life, Bob. He said, oh, for Christ's sake, shut up.
He explained.
He used to wave his finger into my nose and he got mad at me. He said, one time I really missed my front teeth. I just... But I wasn't going to give him the pleasure of gumming it. He says, listen, they're not trying to put you down. Can't you understand this? They don't know what the hell you're talking about. I've been telling you this for a year. They don't know what you're talking about. Kamchatka vodka doesn't go boom to them. To them, it goes blah, blah, blah. That's why you're in this meeting and they're not. I said, oh yes, I knew that. But that really is still to me the ultimate test to be understood. People wonder if they're really alcoholic. Well, I haven't been in jail the way they have. I haven't lost the things. My problems are always deeper. Tell you, I don't know if you're an alcoholic. Would you like to go through life with problems and cares? Would you be satisfied to have your back to the wall and the hounds of fate ripping at your throat and take a drink and have it go? Is that what you want, Blinky? Or are you like some of us? Back to the wall, hounds at the fate at your throat. There we go. You alone, Granny? Take your job and shove it, Mr. Carlson. You want to try your luck, Copper? You may wonder later why you said those things. But if alcohol has the power to remedy the world around you, you will never find anything better. And the only problem with people who have that problem, they have no idea that it is unique unto them and that that is part of the nature of the illness. It's not what alcohol does to you at all. People are always measuring if they're an alcoholic by what alcohol does to them. I could always stay out of AA. I stayed out of AA for years. Went to meetings and left again because AA didn't do to me what it did to them and I had underlying reasons. And I never, I never heard him say it. It's what it does for you. It's what it does for you. And in conjunction with that, something else must be present. Sustained reality must eventually become unbearable. And it always seemed to me, if you're an alcoholic, reality was supposed to be wonderful. But truly, in the disease of alcoholism, it turns out what makes an alcoholic is that reality always becomes unbearable. But that doesn't make you an alcoholic. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who have all the feelings you and I have, who we think are unique unto us. The obsessions, the reactions, the fears, the desperations, the lonelinesses, who are not alcoholics. They are known scientifically as intense or acute neurotics. They are people who live in reality. They're not psychotic. They fill the psychiatric couches of the world. Some are very successful. Some are very famous. But inside, the churn goes on. They are the people for whom the Valiums were invented. They are the people for whom the Darvons were invented. They're the people for whom this,
the depressants to hold down these intense, conflict-prone personalities. But they're not alcoholics because of one thing. Alcohol does not have the unusual property of rectifying the problem. To be living in an untenable reality turns out to make you an intense neurotic, approaching psychosis in some cases. Alcoholics never become psychotic. The cases of alcoholics becoming psychotic through emotional conflict are like hen's teeth, because alcoholics can always remedy by drinking alcohol. Scientists who study alcoholics say alcoholics can get to a point where they literally must drink to preserve their sanity. And yet people like me, and I presume like you, go to AA and get sober and feel bad and say, I'm not an alcoholic, you see, because I'm unhappy when I'm sober. And the hardest thing for to learn and remember is that the function of alcoholics now has come to learn. So you, after you learn it, you just wonder why you ever guessed otherwise. But that is to somehow make reality more pleasant. It seems so obvious. But when I'm like me, at 15, or 20, or 25, or 30, sitting in the Texas Insane Asylum, a successful suicide brought back to life, and no hope it can ever get better. The only way they got to slow me down is shock treatments, 3 a week for many, many weeks, just till I don't know my name or where I'm from. Now, what's stopping drinking going to do for me? Go to AA with their little pleasantnesses and turn your life over to God's and just do the right thing, it'll be wonderful. And you know that it may work, but it doesn't work in my life. Sure, maybe I'll change my life. Can you put it back to November of 1954? Just before December 7th of 1954, just before I caused my best friend to commit suicide, and it's haunted me as long as I can remember. But being sober now won't change that. Can you put me back to maybe December 6th, 1950, just before I went out and got drunk and left my little son die at home? Then we could change that. Let's do that. Or make it go back to. But these things have all happened, and it's too late. And the sadness and the deep sorrow is there. Make it go back to where I'm still in third grade. Let me stay in third grade and I'll become valedictorian. Let me go back to some other time, some other place. Because whatever it is, I don't like the pain. I can't stand the pain. My pain threshold is tremendously low. That was always one of the great curses of my life. People always said they could always tell how I felt. I had no defense at all. When I felt bad, people know I felt bad. And that's still true today. I think of that today. What I used to think was a terrible curse, that low threshold of pain, has turned out to be a lifesaver for me. Because I've watched so many people in AA who've developed a high threshold of pain and stopped doing this, and just stop doing it until they die from it. I've never been able to stay away from AA very long without being so uncomfortable I have to come back. That's the great thing about being on a short tether from AA. You may think, well, he's some kind of fanatic, he has to go all the time. I'm glad that I have to go all the time, because I've watched so many people go over the cliff who didn't even know are off the path because their high threshold of pain didn't tell them. It's good to know when you're hurting, because then you do something about it. But I went to AA, and I did these things, and I lost everything I had. And I had some successes and failures. And the last day I had a drink, standing outside of a Skid Row mission in a cold rain, part of me was a burned-out, old, cynical, nasty, pseudo-intellectual, much-read person, much-traveled person. And a real part of me was a was a boy without social skills from the third grade wondering why they didn't like me. When I drank, I didn't care if they liked me. When I was sober, I cared so much, I had to pretend I didn't care at all. And that's why I am glad that I was driven finally to do things we talk about all the time here. We've all done them, so I guess we just take them for granted, but they're such a miracle. Being driven finally to take actions you don't agree with. To finally take actions you don't agree with. To come to get the first glimmer of identification and think, my God, maybe. Maybe not. I think what's the greatest thing about the first few steps of AA that's so often misunderstood, at least I misunderstood it. I kept thinking, I had to find a solution somewhere in them. There had to be a solution. And there's no solution in the first steps of AA. They are all just acceptance of where you are. You don't have to find any solution in the first step. All you have to admit is, I'm having trouble with my drinking, and I'm having trouble sober. That's all. All you do is admit that, but we read all sorts of intricate things in there. One of the hardest things in my life in AA is to remember it is simpler than I thought it could possibly be. In fact, the hardest battle in AA is surviving long enough to get your own head simple enough to be able to accept AA for what it is. Not having to add esoteric extras all the time. Spooky insights. And now the meeting's over, come over to my house. We have a little advanced insights. And it makes you sick with envy until you see them at the next meeting, your eyes are going, we know truth. The last time I knew truth, I went to the insane asylum. You know, God speaks to me. God's going to tell you to have a beer one day, Ace. You know? Seen it happen a lot, boy, I'll tell you. But the second step says we're going to, what? Going to come to believe in something, what? Who knows? But you're not going to return to anything. I've often thought, how could I return to God when the Lutheran God has marked me for extinction? And my response was, I never have to return to anything in AA. That's the whole concept here. Get away from them. You start new. Little by little. You know, again in passing, there's a thing that we all would like to find in AA but isn't there. We'd like to take this bucket full of filthy, grubby, opaque water and throw it out and fill it with fresh, pure water. But it can't be that way in the human condition. What AA says, you take a cup of pure water and pour it in the dirty slop, and some of it splashes out. You take another cup of water, and a little, after a long time, starts to lighten up a little bit. But you can't take a life and throw it out. You must take it little by little, and little by little. And one day, after a long time, it's clean, or cleanest you'll ever think it is going to be. But we can't change our entire lives. What we do is change direction. The old analogy I've always liked is, you know, we sometimes hear old timers say things like, I came to AA and I threw in the towel, and since then I've lived at peace. And it's hard to remember. Nobody does that. Maybe 1 in 10 million. What you do as human beings, you throw in the towel, and when the heat's off, you inch it back. And you spend the rest of your natural life tearing off small strips. See if that'll satisfy the dirty bastards. Endless surrender. Endless things. But you never have to return to anything. Only one sentence in the book. Some people want to return to normal living, I guess. I don't. Normal living was just hideous. That was designed, you don't got to remember, when the book was written, most of the alcoholics at that time were people who had grown up to maturity, made some basic adjustment to living, crossed the invisible line, drank themselves into extinction, but they had a memory of a place they had been once where it was going pretty good. But today, a lot of AA are people who've never had any basic adjustment to life. It's all been terra incognita for them. Where do you want to return to? I don't know. To Billy Westwind? Yeah. We don't want to return. Came to believe that some power greater than ourselves, and they talk about God, knowledgeably about God, but when I was new, I couldn't accept God because of my own fallibilities. I didn't go to prayer meetings, and I didn't know about God because I felt if God existed, I certainly was damned. So I came to believe. My sponsor said, you believe in AA? I said, no. He said, do you think I'm doing better than you are? I said, yep. I didn't like it, but he was. He says, congratulations, I'm your new higher power. And he became my higher power, and people were just, they started a little, whatever conversation there was about me. You know what he's done now? Yeah, Bob Bailey's his higher power. I out-survived most of those pukes. Because I'll tell you something. I would rather see any newcomer come to believe in something you really believe in. Come to believe in your sponsor that you really believe in, rather than pretend to believe in the God that you don't believe in so you look good at the meeting. Because sometimes it gets to be 2 a.m. and you're going to have to turn to what you believe in. And if you ain't got nothing except trying to look good, you're dead. But I did things to please my sponsor. I hated him much of the time. He hurt my feelings a lot. But I had a begrudging respect because he told me, he acted toward me as though I felt I deserved. That's always been one of the odd things I think about people like me, maybe like some of you. But people that were really nice to me, I never respected. Because I thought, they're too easily fooled. People who treated me like a piece of crap, I hated them, but I kind of respected them because they could see through my crap, and I hated them for it. But the time comes when your back's against the wall, you'll turn to someone you respect, not to someone you like, because then you've got to have an answer that's going to save your life. You've got to go to the doctor who's going to tell you where the cancer is, not saying, don't worry about it, just pay up your insurance, You've got to have somebody who's going to be there. But I came, as I did things to please my sponsor, and I came to believe in AA, and one day I came to believe in God. I found myself praying, and I've prayed to Him earnestly every day since. And I go back for years, I went back to pick my mother to the Norwegian Lutheran Church, and I sat there and thought, how did this stuff always seem so threatening to me? What they're doing is the same thing they're doing in AA, except they don't, in my opinion, they have a much harder sell. Because they can't say to people, if you don't do these things, you'll get drunk. They got to say, somebody, you'll go to hell. Well, shit, I got a little time before that, Same thing with psychiatrists. Tough sell. I've heard psychiatrists tell me this very same thing. They envy AA. We have a finite punishment. A finite hell. They have to say, you may get into deep conflicts that'll bring you pain. Not today, Jim. Here we've got an easy... We have a line of demarcation. Never have to worry about hypocrites in AA. If you think a guy's a hypocrite, you just walk up and say... You can smell hypocrites in AA. No place else. You got to judge how they're doing. But you come to believe that a power greater than yourself somehow will do what? Restore you to sanity. What is sanity? Million definitions of sanity. Insanity is a relatively easy thing to define. It's when your brain, the psychosis under sufficient conflict, to oversimplify it, will set up an artificial environment to reduce the conflict. It turns out alcoholics do the same thing, only they use alcohol. I can literally induce temporary psychosis. I can make reality look different to reduce conflict. So I had to always come to believe the third step is, somehow I got to come to believe that some power greater than myself is going to restore me to living in sustained, unrelieved reality. But it doesn't say how, and you don't have to know how. And then you got to turn your will and your life over to the care of whatever power you're trying to believe in, whether it's your sponsor or AA or God or whatever it might be. And none of these things, you ever have to find out then what it is. You just have to act as though you do it. You don't have to understand why. Why has killed more people in AA than anything I know? All you have to understand is where you are is untenable, and you better try this, because there's rooms full of people saying it worked for me, and all you've got is your mind saying, I don't think it'll work for me. That's why that identification is so important. That's why here, from time to time, people like me, and I presume like you, will have the greatest gift you'll ever get. Of after a lifetime of hearing people say, I understand, you will hear somebody say, I understand, and you will believe that this one does understand. That is the identification. We talk all a lot about what AA is. All these things, what AA is and what it means. Should we have a narcotics addict? Should we have overeaters? Aren't we all one big sickness? No. Alcoholics Anonymous is the same today as it was June 10th, 1935, when Bill Wilson sat moodily at Dr. Bob's bedside and wondered if he could get him to stop shaking long enough to do that surgery. And it's just this. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to establish at least enough identification to reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he will begin to take actions that he does not yet believe in. And that's what it's all about. Everything else is secondary to that. The book is not Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a book about Alcoholics Anonymous. The meetings are not Alcoholics Anonymous. The central office is not Alcoholics Anonymous. The literature is not Alcoholics Anonymous. This convention is not Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference and alter his perception of reality so he need not live in agony. And everything is part, all the other things are secondary aids to that goal. So that's what you got to remember. And I got to keep remembering. That's why I stay active in AA. I'm blessed with a short, low threshold of pain. It doesn't take much to make me feel bad. Over the years, I've carefully and assiduously developed an immaturity denied to me in my youth. Because I've discovered that's the only way you can maintain enthusiasm. I don't mean that you have to be childish to be maintaining enthusiasm, but there's something to be said about the enthusiasm that comes in AA. Because it doesn't always stay. We'd like to have it stay, but it doesn't. But you all know, I've said this a lot of times too. Interesting, the root of the word enthusiasm. It's from the Greek. They use the word enthusiasm. Means an within, theos, God. Enthusiasm is the Greek word meaning the expression of the God within. The expression of God. The expression of being part of life. Being part of the spiritual song of the world. It would be so wonderful if we could maintain it, but we can't because we're human beings and we sometimes get cross. We forget, we get ungrateful, and we get petty, and we get gossipy, and we get nasty, and we get selfish, and we know better, and it's frustrating. And that's why it's necessary for people like me, and I presume like you, to keep coming back. To get that focus redirected, to try to find ways to remember that this is a great miracle in my life. Being sober 31 years is nice, But it isn't anywhere near as nice as standing in a shower tonight for a half an hour and thinking, I can't think of a single serious bad thing in my life. I don't know very many people in the world at any level who could say that. I bet you wish Gorbachev wishes he could say that. You know, everything is fine except that goddamn Estonia and that Azerbaijan and this thing on my head. So it's really amazing, after knowing all about AA and failing, to wind up at a point where after all these years I can look and say the most impressive and important thing I can tell you about a self-obsessed, self-pitying little boy who grew into a self-obsessed, self-pitying, suicidal, craven man hiding behind a wall of imitation, intellectual arrogance and defiance. To be able to stand at this podium tonight or anywhere in that shower or anywhere and tell you the most remarkable thing. It turns out, after all of this, my name is Clancy Immersland and I'm an alcoholic. I would have bet my life I wasn't after being around AA 9 years and being dying on the street. I had no idea that alcoholism is sober and drinking. That the untenability of sobriety, plus the absolutely momentary omnipotence of drinking, is the definition of alcoholism, not how much time you've been in jail or how much you drank. And through the power of 12 steps, which I could recite in the nut house without reading it, and it got worse after that, the same dumb steps that I laughed at and sneered at in bars, saved my life and my sanity and brought me to a point where I could develop a profound respect and gratitude to a loving God that I would bet my life did not exist ever. The analogy I've often, the experience I think about a few years ago, sitting in Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, with my mother's little casket there. And so glad she'd died because she'd gone through a terrible time. And then another year or so later with my father, casket in the same place. And sitting there and looking around this church that I had sat in terror and resentment and never went back into it. I was sober a long time, took my mother to church when I came home. But look around that church and looking at those old people who used to be such frightening and imposing people. You know, they're just little old frightened people and old people. I thought to myself, if I got nothing else out of AA than this, to discover that God in the Norwegian Lutheran Church is exactly the same God that's in the Pacific Group in Los Angeles, that's in the meetings that I've come to believe in, that means good for me and is only frustrated by my own crap that screws it up from time to time. He means well for me. But he's not going to do it for me. And that's what I think about when I step over the men on Skid Row. I think, why am I so lucky? You and I are the same man, but you're dying there, and I'm not. Because somehow, the television set got turned on, so I got the picture. And you declined to turn yours on. And I feel sorry for you. And I hope you die easy, pal, because there's no other way out. But the miracle, to discover my name is Clancy Immersland, I'm an alcoholic, through the power of 12 steps and the fellowship of thousands of men and women, many of whom who have since died drunk, many of whom have died sober, some who are in this room, and through the grace of a loving God who means well for me if I let him, I have an opportunity to live in some degree of dignity most of the time as long as I live. Now, to most places that wouldn't sound like much, but I'm sure to you understand what I'm saying. And that's why it's so important. you and I can't go back and spend a lot of years grinding about what happened to us when we were little and what this parent did to us and why we're upset. It's all things that we have to come to deal with. But the time comes in AA when you got to say, then is then, now is now, now let's live with dignity. Let's find a way to do it. Let's try to remember to surrender to people who can show us how. And then it becomes all worthwhile. Thank you.